Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 302 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Hannah Vincent speaks with Bethan Roberts about how acting led her to playwriting, working as a script editor, her mid-career move into fiction, the core self that drives creativity, and some of the recurring themes in her work.
I'm here with Hannah Vincent. Hannah is an award-winning writer of plays, novels, and short stories. She began her career in writing as a playwright, winning the Royal Court Young Writer of the Year Award with her first stage play, which was an adaptation of Kafka's short story, The Burrow. She went on to write a number of plays in the joint stock method developed by Max Stafford Clarke. Hannah later worked as a television script editor for BBC Drama, collaborating on classic adaptations such as Great Expectations and Crime and Punishment, as well as original dramas. Her first radio drama, Come to Grief, was a version of a stage play she wrote whilst writer-in-residence at the Royal National Theatre Studio. It won the 2015 BBC Audio Award for Best Adaptation. Hannah's first novel, Alarm Girl, was published by Myriad Editions in 2014, and her second, The Weaning, was published by Salt in 2018. She has a PhD in Creative and Critical Writing from the University of Sussex, and Hannah also teaches creative writing on the Open University's MA and Life Writing on the Autobiography and Life Writing programme at New Writing South in Brighton. Hannah, that is quite a list of stuff. So I thought we could begin by talking about your amazing ability to write in almost every genre, it seems. I mean, do you want to tell me a bit about why your career began with drama, do you think?
I think my career began with writing drama because I was doing drama as an undergrad degree, wanting to be an actor, like quite a few of my peers. Did a lot of acting at college, college and university. And then, obviously, couldn't get into acting as a career. So found myself graduating and going into a insurance company and taking the staples out of cheques and kind of filing. And that was a very politicising experience, shall we say. And during that period, I did just a one-day workshop that was a Royal Court travelling workshop, so I think maybe taking their work out to the regions, and the piece I wrote for it was well received on the day, or, you know, somebody, Kate Harwood, in fact, who was literary manager there, really liked it and encouraged me to finish it and send it to them, which I then did, and then it got selected, and then I was off. And so I really benefited from her encouragement. And hilariously and entirely coincidentally, I had a playwriting career, and, you know, 10 years later, that had slightly run out of steam, and I found myself bookselling. And while I was there, applied for a job at the BBC as a script reader and got that job. And lo and behold, the first person I saw outside of the lift on my first day was Kate Harwood, who'd gone from theatre into telly and was then an up-and-coming producer of TV drama, and then ended up Mrs. BBC, you know, very kind of, influential again in TV. But again, supported me in my television career. It's very important to have mentors and people who, you know, respect and admire you and kind of are going to give you a leg up, because I was very lucky to have her encouragement.
So was writing something that you'd always done as an actor? Because you said you were wanting to act.
Yeah.
So you were writing as well at the same time, or did it just come?
Yeah, have always written since I was little. And then as an actor, when we wanted a new play to take to Edinburgh Fringe Festival of Students, and that was very pragmatic. We wanted a new play, so we wouldn't have to pay copyright for it. So that, looking around, who can write us a play? So my hand went up, I'll write us a play. So I did, I wrote us a play, What a Little Boy's Made Of, which was set in a school reunion where all the people that turn up are women but have once been men.
Right.
transgender issues are very prominent now, but it was very, people didn't really talk so much about those things. And we had one guy that turned up every night for the performances, and I did say to him, you know, at the end of the run, oh, you've been coming to see this play every night. And he said, yeah, I'm planning to have a gender reorientation. And then a few years later, he phoned me up as she. So that was really very exciting and heartening that he really appreciated some of the issue. I mean, it was a very cartoony kind of play, but he did nevertheless appreciate some of the issues it was raising.
So how long were you playwriting? About 10 years?
Yeah, about 10 years. And I had a very nice time as a playwright. Very lucky to be in rehearsal rooms. In fact, only one play of mine, I wasn't in the rehearsal room, and that was much less of a happy experience. I was very comfortable in a rehearsal room, and I had very generous and talented directors and extremely generous and talented actors to work with, and non-actors, you know, as well. Some of the work I did at the Court was with people who weren't professional actors, young people and young unemployed people, long-term unemployed people. But found myself getting slightly steered into youth theatre and TIE, Theatre in Education, which I actually wasn't interested in, and which I wonder whether that was a gender bias. I was probably spent 10 years as a playwright, and the last few years of that, I felt like I was being squeezed into writing for young audiences, and I didn't see my male playwright colleagues being steered in the same way. That might be wrong. That might have just been what people saw in my writing and they thought it would be appropriate for young audiences. But the fact is that I wasn't interested in writing for children and young audiences, and I found it harder perhaps to get my work away for grown-ups.
And was that about the time that you
switched to waitressing and bookselling?
And bookselling. Yeah, which are both, you know, important part of any writer's career.
They are, yeah. And did some travelling. Yeah, did some travelling. Right. So kind of took time out, I guess, for a bit.
And do you think that was helpful for your writing, to have
really,
that time out?
Yeah. And I would still advocate that for any writer now. You know, I moan about the time that I don't have to do my writing, but equally I know that my writing life is enriched by the time I spend outside of my... I was going to say my artist's garret, but I don't write in an artist's garret. Outside of my bed, where I write. You know, it is enriched by the people I encounter and the stories I hear and just the world of work that I operate in. And I guess I was still had a little bit of a toe in the water because I was reading scripts for the Bush Theatre at the time. So I still had that contact with theatre.
Yeah.
And then had a glorious few years at the BBC. Love that.
Did you?
Glorious.
What was so glorious about the BBC?
Oh, you know what? It was having a desk to go to. having a world of work to enter, having colleagues that stood around in their office doorways chatting, water cooler moments. It was a nice time to be alive as well. You know, new Labour government had just come in. Everything was feeling quite optimistic and hopeful. I had my first baby. Oh, you know, it was a good time. A good time of life.
And it was all right to have first baby and be working at the BBC?
Yes.
That worked okay?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I mean, you'd have a proper job and then have a maternity package. Mm. Amazing.
Mm. And what was it like doing the script editing? How creative was that for you?
Yeah.
Did you find that, you know, thoroughly satisfying, or you did?
Yes, for the first few years, very satisfying. Again, I benefited from having very generous producers who invited me into the process and were very keen for me to be involved. Worked with some very lovely writers who were very appreciative of my efforts on their behalf in terms of getting their script made and in terms of getting their script to the best possible standards. And it was really creative, you know. Read Great Expectations and say where you think we should break for the episodes, you know, things like that. You know, and you're discussing that in relation to the writer as well, you know. But your opinion is called for, and that's always nice, isn't it, to have your opinion asked for. And, you know, again, producers saying, have a flick through Spotlight. These were in the days where you had a big kind of volume of Spotlight photographs. Have a flick through Spotlight and see if you can see who we should cast.
So were you writing your own stuff at that time, or were you happy to sort of put it aside?
Very interesting, in that I didn't write for the entire period I was working on other people's scripts. It's probably the only time in my life where I haven't written. Didn't write for all those years, apart from one week in which I had a first aid training course, and because I wasn't working with script, with words, absolutely burst forth the writing, because I suppose that kind of muscle was very flexed and ready, but it wasn't being used. And I can't remember what I wrote in that week. It was only a week, but I do remember the feeling of it bursting forth like a geezer, you know, mixing my metaphors here. Muscles, geezers. It gives some idea, hopefully, of the kind of energy with which the writing spewed out of me, you know. Yeah. And it possibly was a play called Family Holiday, which then gave rise to the manuscript for my first novel, which I wrote as a play first, but it didn't really work as a play. Right. I think that's what came out of that week. Yeah. But yeah, apart from that, I didn't write.
So do you think, in a way, it was quite good to have kept a lid on it and then let it come out?
I mean, that goes against the advice I would give any other writer, because I think it's really important to keep up a regular practice, and that's what I would tell my students, and that's what I do myself, is try and keep up a regular daily practice if I can. But actually, for me, it's almost like a yogic thing where you acknowledge how your writing self is and how it feels, and if it doesn't feel that the writing is coming, you can't force it. You can't force it. So just go with the flow. And actually, my flow at that time was going with other people's writing, and that was actually really good for me. Just to go with other people's writing, apply my skills and my kind of understanding of the writing craft to other people's work. You know, the job of a script editor is an extremely generous one. You give all your skills and expertise in that to that other person's writing. And actually, you do, by the end of my script editing career, I was seeing ideas that I'd come up with being appropriated by other people and feeling slightly under kind of recognised or under acknowledged. That, you know, those script editors put the work in, and actually their name is quite low down on the credits. So possibly it was a little bit frustrating by the end of my career, but also I was then had my second child. And, you know, I had other priorities. I wanted to be at home with my children. So that came to a natural end, and actually at a time when script editors were being invited to train as producers, and I wasn't interested in being a producer.
Right.
It was geographical as much as anything, because the work was in London, I was in Brighton. I didn't do all that networking. I didn't want to be in London particularly. I wanted to be in Brighton. So it was a geographical shift. It was a shift in terms of my family commitments. And it was a shift away from other people's writing and towards my own practice as well. But, all that felt quite organic. And then having a second child who was a very good sleeper, you know, in the day he would have a big two-hour kip, then just meant I had time for writing. And actually now my regular practice is only ever 2 hours. I can't ever do more than 2 hours good writing. And I wonder whether that was dictated by my youngest child's habits. I got into a rhythm. You know, my house was absolutely filthy, like covered in toys and food, and to the extent that a friend of mine who lived down the road, when her mum came to visit, she showed her, oh, that's, you know, that's my friend Hannah's house, and they looked through my window, apparently, saw the chaos, and her mum turned to her and said, is she all right? Because she thought I might have mental health problems.
Just got two
young children. And writing, you know, I never forget what J.K. Rowling said. You know, J.K. Rowling said, you know, I was a single mother with a young child. Do you think I was superwoman? You know, no, something had to give, and it was the state of my house. She said the same, her house was filthy. My house was filthy. It's still filthy. I've tied it up for you today, Bethan. But I live in filth because I would rather spend my time, you know, writing.
Now, I'm interested in that two-hour slot that you had. So that was when you started writing again for yourself,
yeah.
I guess. Did that come out then as drama or prose, or what happened there? Because I'm interested in this transition now between drama and prose and what was going on.
Yeah, so I think the writing that came out of that 1 week first aid course, I think was, I wish I could remember, but I think it was drama. And I tried to make it work and I couldn't make it work. It didn't work as a play. I didn't even finish it. So that was half hanging in the balance. And then having my child, you know, then that took me into Babyland. But then once Babyland was a familiar territory, and like I say, my youngest child was sleeping for 2 hours a day, I turned to my writing and it was straight away, it was prose, not drama, that I turned to.
So you hadn't considered writing stories or novels before?
No.
Before that moment, really.
And it was as much pragmatic because maybe even though I worked with very sound and kind of generous-spirited people in theatre, maybe I couldn't imagine being in a rehearsal space with a young child. You know, as much as anything, it might be practical. You know, novel writing seems more something that you could do in isolation.
Yes.
And it was, I remember finding it very odd and interesting, writing prose, so having to fill in the bits in between the stage directions. You know, I was used to writing, you know, what people said, you know, just the tip of the iceberg, just their dialogue and a setting and some gesture. But the idea of filling in what the sky looked like and what the light was like coming through that room, I mean, it was just ludicrous. I remember laughing at myself as I wrote the words because they seemed so clunky and ridiculous. But quite enjoying that shift of form and enjoying the stupidness. You know, it felt a little bit clumsy. I mean, it felt clumsy, and probably because my writing was very clumsy. But it was filling in the gaps. It felt so dense and heavy compared to the lightness of playwriting, which is just what people say and how they move in a space, you know.
I think your writing has a great lightness of touch because you know, you are so good at those drama bits, and actually that's very refreshing, I think, you know, when you're reading a novel, that you feel like the dialogue and the action is doing a lot of work, you know. I mean, you must feel that kind of long apprenticeship really in script writing and drama has really informed your fiction.
Yeah, oh, totally. Served me very well in terms of dialogue. Because I find dialogue really easy. I know I can write, you know, believable dialogue. And it's only about listening to people. But I was taught to listen to how people speak as a playwright. How people and are. How people don't offer direct answers to questions. You're kind of paying attention to the rhythms of people's speech. So I know I can write dialogue. And I do see other writers struggling with that, and student writers, but I see other published writers whose dialogue isn't, you know, convincing. So that, and then also an editor once said, oh, I found it really easy to edit your work because I always know who's in the room and who's standing where. And I think, again, that is from playwriting. We, as playwrights, you have to know who's standing where in order to understand how that power balance looks on the stage. You have to know who's coming in when and who's leaving when, so you're mindful of who's in the space. And so I think that really helps prose writing. It helps a reader keep in mind who's in the space, even when that person isn't the person that's at the focus of the drama or isn't the person that's speaking at that moment. You know, the writer needs to know where they are, where that character is.
Yeah.
So that definitely helps.
Yeah.
I'm thinking in terms of scene as well.
Yes.
I mean, I talk to my students about writing beads on a necklace, and the beads are just scenes that you might want to write, and then you string them all together and see how they fit. And I think that's a really pleasurable way of writing because it means you can go for the treats. You just write the scenes that you want to write, don't you? You write the scenes that you want to write, and then you see where they fit.
So just talk a bit about your first novel then, Alarm Girl, which is a very powerful novel about a girl dealing with grief, really, I think. And I think this theme of how you deal with grief and what happens to kind of memories and stories of lives and what happens particularly when they're kind of pushed away or not allowed to come out, seems to me that's quite a fascination of yours in both your novels and in Come to Grief, your radio drama. I'm wondering if that's something you're aware of, whether you know that that's a theme you come back to, or whether it's just something that comes up.
Yeah, it's just something that comes up, because when I look at my life, I totally can see where all those three subjects, where they come from. But they're possibly, I think it's my drama queenness. as much as anything, I'm a drama queen. You know, and I have that reputation in my family for over-dramatising situations. And so what I think I've done in all my work is take something that isn't particularly dramatic, you know, the idea that people in my family are very polite to one another and we don't shout and we don't display and we don't emote, and then pushing that to the extreme. What would happen in a family like this if something terrible had happened and people didn't talk about it? I mean, luckily in my family, so far as I know, nothing terrible has happened. And possibly if it did happen, we would all talk about it a lot and emote and display our emotion. It's the Stanislavskian thing. Stanislavski's an actor trainer, and he talks about the magic what if. What if? And as an actor, you have to be able to do that. What if I had killed my own children? I have to know what that might feel like in order to play Medea. But I might not have killed, well, hopefully I haven't killed my own children. So I have to imagine, I have to take myself back to the moment when I accidentally killed that goldfish and remember those feelings and then apply that. So I think that's what I'm doing. I'm going, what if in this family this thing happened? And the same with Come to Grief, which I was less, because I was younger when I wrote the original play, I was less conscious of what that was about. I thought I was writing a play about the Loch Ness Monster. Writing a play about the Loch Ness Monster with one hand, and then with the other hand found myself writing this other play, which was quite strange and had this woman at the centre of it who was hanging above the kind of action. And I didn't really know what that play was about, but that was the play that people were much more interested in. You know, they weren't particularly interested in the thing I was writing about, the Loch Ness Monster. But they were saying, wow, that's interesting. What's that about? Push that. And actually, when my mum came to see it, she was quite distressed by it. And I think as an older person and as a mother, I can see why. You know, it was about my relationship with her and it was about the shift in our relationship. But at the time, I didn't know that that's what I was writing about. So I'm a great advocate of just writing those beads. Don't worry about where they're coming from, because if you don't know where they're coming from, the chances are they're coming from somewhere really powerful and important. It's your unconscious that's doing part of the writing. Then you have to do the kind of conscious, kind of crafty shaping and structuring. But ignore that kind of that messy, unconscious thing at peril, you know.
Yeah. I've read in another interview with you that you've said about this apparent loss of control a writer experiences when a character takes over the story. A lot of writers talk about that, don't they? That, you know, the characters just do their own thing. And you said in your view this is a sensation that occurs when the writing self and the psychic self become aligned, which I guess is connected to what you were just saying. And I think it's a fascinating idea. Tell me a bit about that. What did you mean by that?
What did I mean by that? I mean, I do subscribe to that theory that, yes, if someone's writing and they go, oh, the characters have got their own life and they're telling me what to do, that's a lovely feeling. But it isn't the character. Obviously, it's not the characters. They don't exist other than in your mind, dear writer. And then dear reader, when they come to it. But what's happening, I think, is that you have sufficiently opened yourself to the writing process to kind of just go where the writing is taking you. And you think that is somewhere that you don't know about, but you do know about it in your deepest, deepest self. But, you know, we have very little access to that self, I think, unless we're on mad psychotropic drugs or if we're having an out-of-body experience in a yoga class or whatever our trip is, you know. And for writers, that is our trip. I think that's a way that people access a really deep core self that, you know, skating around on the surface of everyday life, we maybe don't access that. And that is why people feel so compelled to write and why it becomes such an addictive practice for some of us.
and why it's so important in people's lives, because it's a way of nourishing and nurturing something really deep and important within ourselves that doesn't get nurtured elsewhere. Mm. You know, certainly doesn't get nurtured by waitressing or book selling.
Mm.
And possibly not even script editing, if the script editing is on somebody else's work, because presumably that work is coming from their deepest core, you know. Mm. So writing our own plays and novels and poems. And I wonder if it's the same for journalists, for articles. Like if you're writing an essay...
Shaking her head.
An essay or an academic piece? No, it's not. I mean, I think people will go to academic writing or journalism for reasons that are connected with their core self, but it's not the same practice. I know that from my own practice, in that when I got a bad back from lying in bed unergonomically typing on my laptop, I tried a standing desk, so I kind of put my laptop on shoeboxes, balanced on a chair, balanced on the table, so that I could stand and write. And I could write academically like that, but I couldn't write creatively because I was too alert, my body was too engaged, I was too kind of sentient. So I think there needs to be something more unconscious, something more prone, and closer to the dream state, Freud's dream state, for creative writing to be, to kind of be as powerful as it can be and to connect with the writer and the reader then. I think if the writer is connected to that core, then the reader's going to be. It's the same as if we're writing a boring scene. If we're bored with our own novel, the reader is going to be bored.
Mm.
You know, if we're really powerfully connected to the themes and the characters and the emotion of what we're writing, the chances are... the reader's going to be, unless I suppose we're really indulging. You know, maybe there's an argument against that, in that, you know, you could get some writing that's very self-indulgent that would exclude the reader. So it's a bit of a balance, isn't it, to strike?
Always a balance, isn't it?
Always a balance in everything.
Yeah. I think that's a good place to stop. I'm going to let you get back to your bed now and do some more writing in the dream state.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You can float off.
Floats off.
Back up the stairs. Thank you so much, Hannah. It's been fascinating to talk to you about your very varied writing career. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Bethan.
That was Hannah Vincent in conversation with Bethan Roberts. You can find out more about Hannah on her website at hannahvincentinfo.com. And that concludes episode 302, which was recorded by Bethan Roberts and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 303, Amanda Dalton meets the deeper self who writes from the gut, and Shahrukh Hussain confronts the challenges of mid-career genre switching. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.